but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. B-F-F-T. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Well, last March, John Carl Schultz was announced as the incoming president at the University of Oregon. Schultz did not arrive on the job until July. 5 weeks later, the University of Oregon and Washington announced they were leaving the Pac-12 conference. A couple of presidents, a couple of interim presidents. Dicey times. I told John Schultz that he must have felt like he was drinking through a fire hose when he arrived at the University of Oregon. I was curious as I went down to Eugene to talk with him early this week. I was curious to find out how that all went down. Board of Trustees involved, certainly some key donors involved like Phil and Penny Knight, but John Schultz, the president at Oregon, really the point person. And so I was invited down, told to go to Johnson Hall, told to meet him at the conference room inside the president's office. And so, it's a room that is featured in Animal House, the movie. It's actually the room where the horse gets scared to death if you watch Animal House. And so I met with President Schultz early this week. And you're going to hear the audio of our interview in two parts, this segment and next. And I really was interested in who is this guy. Let's get a feel for him. And why Oregon did what it did. And then what comes next? What about the travel demands on athletes? What can be done to assist Oregon State, a fellow public institution that was harmed by the departure of Oregon to the Big Ten Conference? What can be done about Autzen Stadium? Will it expand? Or is this uptick in interest from fans really just more about curiosity and Ohio State coming to Autzen Stadium? Will fans show up to see Rutgers, Maryland, Wisconsin, others, or not? So I sat down with Carl Schultz, the president at Oregon, and in this first part that you're going to hear, I'll just let you in, on kind of the backstory and my strategy in interviewing somebody that I had not sat down with before, had no prior interactions with. Certainly on a year-to-year basis, I have interviewed his predecessors once a year or so, and I wanted to get to know this guy. I wanted to know what he was about. And you're going to feel me in the early parts of this interview, not unlike a boxing match where fighters are feeling each other out, throwing a little jab, dancing around the ring. You're going to feel me kind of building some rapport with Carl Schultz, trying to figure out what he's about, asking him about his family, asking him about, the teams he rooted for when he grew up. And then I really start to dive into the interview. And it's part of what I enjoy when I'm interviewing people is that dance that you're involved in. Here's part one of my interview with the University of Oregon president in his office, in his conference room.
Onboarding, your entry here at Oregon, what has it been like for you in the last, this stretch of time or this season of life?
Just overwhelmingly positive. People have been incredibly warm and gracious. There's great people here. And so, you know, you use the phrase drinking from a fire hose. Certainly there's some of that, but also, again, people have been incredibly welcoming. And I get to work with great people, and so we can start to try to focus on the things that will really make a positive difference for the university. So it's been really exhilarating.
As I look around the campus, just in 20 years, it's exploded. It's striking to me how vibrant it is and how alive it is. You in higher education, are you seeing that everywhere, or is this is this an Oregon thing?
So the Pacific Northwest, I think, is special with the climate, the ethic of the people, the physical beauty. We like to say the majestic Pacific Northwest. So we have geographical advantages, but then you know, we benefit from investments in the state of Oregon, great people here who have planned and you know, charted the future. I mean, my predecessor, Mike Schull, and his colleague, Patrick Phillips, did a wonderful job helping to build up the university, and I'm the beneficiary of a lot of great people doing a lot of great work over a long period of time.
Yeah, there was that transition was interesting with Schill and then two interims and then you and then all the Pac-12 stuff going on amid that. I'm interested in that stuff particularly. How did you get briefed? Like, how does that happen when you come in the door, you know, and you go, okay, catch me up to speed. Mm-hmm. Athletics was that kind of a pivot point. And then, of course, you have everything else in the university that you obviously need to pay attention to.
Yeah. Well, again, I have subject matter experts in almost every domain of the university, so you listen and learn from them. In addition, in the specific question about athletics, I've been a lifelong sports fan, and so I came in with a certain, you know, background. I spent, you know, 35 years of my career at an outstanding Big Ten institution. I happened to be interim chancellor at UW-Madison when USC and UCLA moved to the Big Ten. So I had some background there, but there's, of course, a lot to learn.
Tell me about that. Sports fan, young sports fan. Who did you root for? Who were your teams?
I grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska. So
okay.
The Cornhuskers were indeed a big deal. Those were the Bob Devaney days. Nebraska football, but then being in Nebraska, you didn't really have a natural pro team. So in baseball, of course, Marshall, Mays, and McCovey were pretty attractive, so I was a San Francisco Giants fan. Football, kind of combination, the LA Rams and the Kansas City Chiefs, just because they were reasonably successful, the Rams never got over the line. Basketball, you know, how could you not love Dr. J and, you know, that?
It's interesting because, you know, I think I grew up a Giants fan and I went to Candlestick Park. That was my place. But I didn't realize how bad it was compared to other stadiums.
Exactly.
Until I got into this job and I got to see some other things. And I was like, oh, okay. It wasn't all that great. Marshall, what a great image. I saw a picture of him yesterday with the leg kick.
Oh, neat.
And I just thought, God, that's such an iconic.
Truly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, in graduate school, it was not to slay on someone. It was the Jim Davenport era.
Yeah.
And Daffy would run his batting order by position. And so, you know, Will Clark wasn't playing. Yeah. He still had some scrub first baseman, you know, batting third or cleanup. It's like, Daffy. And they're losing, you know, more than 100 games a year.
I was there. Fan Appreciation Day.
Oh, my gosh.
I think it was 1985. They lost 100th game.
Yeah.
I was there that day.
Unbelievable.
I think we all should have got a car or something.
Well, or the quad of Candlestick.
Yeah. I have one of those.
I got a bunch of them still at home.
I love that.
Yeah.
Parents, tell me about your parents, like your influences. Growing up in your household as a kid, what was that like?
Great parents, unbelievably stable childhood, born and raised in the same household until I went off to college. My father was a chemistry professor at the University of Nebraska. And my mom actually had a master's degree in microbiology, but was a, you know, kind of classic stay-at-home mom. Great, great childhood.
I think about that. You know, you obviously you have a positive association with education. Started there.
Yeah.
They came home and you saw that as this is something I'd be interested in.
I think that's true, although I never thought, oh, I'm going to be an academic. After college, I had paid a deposit to go to law school and then, you know, got a different opportunity and put me on a different path. And so it's serendipity. I think all of us, if you're fortunate enough, you know, you think there's, you know, someone on your shoulder who's been kind of helping, and you get these breaks, and I'm no different.
There's a little Forrest Gump in every story, you know? Yeah. I think about that.
Yeah.
So the interest in economics, was that something, were you an entrepreneur? Did you have a lemonade stand? Did you sell, you know, did you have ideas?
Not at all. Love the perspective that economics provides to try to understand the world. And so whether it's supply and demand or the idea of constrained optimization, doing the best you can subject to the constraints that you face, I just loved and found very, very useful and engaging the structure that economics provides to understand, you know, whether my own life or the world around us.
Siblings in your house?
Yeah, an older sister.
Did she also go into higher ed? Or?
No, but we're very, very, very different.
Isn't that funny how that goes? I have three daughters, and they are across, creative and analytical, logical.
Yeah, they differentiate themselves. Same thing here. Similar.
It's almost like there's not enough room in the household for two of the same.
Exactly.
So you have to fight.
Well, I joked around. So my dad and mom were physical scientists. My sister got a master's degree in linguistics. Mm-hmm. And so I had to study social sciences.
I'm curious what you think then with your background in economics. We're hearing about private equity in conferences, private equity in universities. Where do you stand on that? Is that a healthy discussion, or do we need to keep private equity out of education?
Yeah. Well, it's healthy to discuss any ideas. That's what universities are about, and that's what good, you know, leadership is about. And so we'll consider anything that comes down the pike. It's way, 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 way too soon to take, you know, say, oh, this is a great idea or a bad idea. I think, if I were a betting person, it's not. I should have stopped my answer when I gave you before.
Let's say if you were a betting
person. But no, that's a long, long, long ways away.
Yeah. As I talk to those companies, they're certainly interested. In athletics, the financials come out. There's self-sufficiency here.
Yeah.
And a lot of schools, most schools are not
correct
self-sufficient. How important is that to you that line is held? Or how proud are you that there's a self-sufficiency here at Oregon?
I'm very, very proud of that. I think there's probably 20 or so, give or take, universities in the country that can make that claim. And that's very, very important.
Donors, if I go back 20 years, I probably could find columns where I was critical. Hey, this isn't healthy to have one donor like, Phil and Penny Knight and have a university reliant on one donor. I've shifted 180 degrees. And I've had this conversation with Phil that, you know what? I think in today's world, you need those donors. You need those tentpole donors, and universities are lucky to have them. That relationship, how important is it to you and this university, the Knights?
Our relationship with everybody who cares about the University of Oregon is critically important, whether it's state legislators, whether it's alums, whether it's teachers. I mean, because we can't do it by ourselves. I could be the greatest president in the world, the most insightful and biggest team, but we don't achieve our potential if everyone's not pulling together. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Knight are extraordinary alums. They care deeply about the state of Oregon. They care deeply about the University of Oregon. And so they're special people. And they give not just to athletics, but they give, enormous amounts to the academic side of the university. And for that, we're incredibly grateful.
That period where you arrive and then the University of Oregon and Washington are going off to the Big Ten in August, it was complicated for me. I grew up on the Pac-12. I grew up watching Stanford and Cal. And in that 108 years of history, hard for me to watch that go. Simultaneously, I put myself in your shoes, and I've talked to some of your trustees. I put myself in their shoes. I think you have to do what's best for yourself. What were those conversations like as that was happening?
So the world of big-time intercollegiate athletics is getting, you know, turned on its head. As I said, I was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison when USC and UCLA came to the Big Ten. That's off the top, 40% of the media market. You know, the University of Colorado moves to the Big 12 before any deal was on the table. And so, you know, this thirst for stability, like you, I feel, you know, deep sadness about the Pac-12, Pac-10, Pac-8. But the world was changing, and the University of Oregon needed to find stability. And we took advantage of an opportunity that provides that stability and then has other collateral benefits, right? So visibility, we have a national brand. And so the ability of people to see us on so-called linear TV, you know, that's really important as we recruit students, not just from the state of Oregon, but from around the country and around the world. And then the Big Ten has a whole set of academic aspects that are going to make us better. So the Big Ten libraries share resources in something called the Big Collection. And so we can draw on the East Asia collection of the University of Michigan and the Latin American collection of UCLA as we share resources. And they in turn can, you know, borrow, you know, our collections, our deep, wonderful collections in the Pacific Northwest. And so that's good. We share teaching of almost never taken or languages, you know, things like Swahili or Urdu, where, you know, tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of people speak these languages. So they're vital for, you know, connected global environment. But there's not demand on it, enough demand on any of our campuses to do, you know, a four semester sequence in Swahili. So we can partner with other institutions. And then there's a whole bunch of leadership training that the Big Ten does just very, very well for department chairs or deans or other vice presidents. And so drawing on that is important. And so that, you know, people say, oh, it's all about money. It's all about money. You know, I'd be lying if I said money didn't play some role here. But these other things are really, really important to us.
I wonder if you had been in the room sooner, if you could have had an influence on the negotiation, you know, given your background and your expertise. When you walk in, I kind of feel like maybe the ship had sailed, or it was just at the point of, is there a deal on the table, not on the table? Was there ever a point where you went, we are staying, and then it became, let's examine the deal? Or was it just, you know, can you take me through the thinking, I guess, or the logic in the 11th hour?
Yeah, it's not... I'd rather not. It was a very, you know, it's a complicated, difficult, yeah. difficult process. And yeah. I think it's best to look forward.
Part one of my interview with Carl Schultz, president of the University of Oregon. And you see there at the end, you know, I led him to the point where we're going to talk in depth about what happened in the 11th hour. He says he doesn't want to go there. I didn't like that. It's his right to not answer the question, but I didn't like how he handled that. And I also kind of, it was all I could do to not fall out of my chair as he begins to talk about languages and Swahili and Urdu. And these are reasons why a partnership with the Big Ten Conference benefits the University of Oregon. We know that football and media money are driving this conversation. And yet, you know, this is the mindset of a university president. It sort of lends insight into, you know, as we watch the Pac-12 blow the media rights negotiation, it lends insight into how these presidents think. It really does. And I'm left, as he's answering the question, sitting there looking at him and going, are you really trying to tell me that this is about, you know, rare languages and the ability to partner with the Big Ten library and all of this other stuff that he's throwing at me? And certainly There's a board of trustees in the background. There are donors like Phil Knight. There are a lot of entities at the table, and a university president left to speak for it all. Stephen, part one of this, anything jump out to you?
It was the money part, and the fact that he at least admitted, like, hey, I'd be lying if money wasn't an issue. Like, at least he admitted it a little bit. But the fact that they're still trying to portray this as it's not all about football. It's not all about money. Like, this is going to help our global brand. Like, I mean, come on. Like, nobody actually believes you when you're going to say that kind of stuff. That was the one thing. At least, I'm glad that he at least admitted a little bit that, like, yeah. Money was an issue. But, of course, they're going to double down on it. That's not the only issue. And, in fact, it is the issue.
Yeah. And look, part two, you're going to hear, it's going to start with me asking about the travel demands in the Big Ten Conference. He said some interesting things there on how Oregon plans to mitigate the extended travel. We also get into the idea of Oregon State. Oregon is a publicly funded university. So is Oregon State. Now, I happen to believe that one publicly funded university should be mindful of another, just like two cars on the road that are driving. You know, we all do what's best for ourselves, but we don't do it at the expense of the driver in the lane beside us. I'll ask him about Oregon State. What can Oregon do to help Oregon State out since there have been some damage done? And then the Autzen Stadium expansion and a couple other things come up in part two of our interview. Stay tuned. Carl Schultz, President, University of Oregon. You'll hear more next. Well, if you caught part one of my interview with Carl Schultz, University of Oregon President, you heard him talking about the departure, got to know him a little bit. Just get a feel for the guy. This isn't a personal comment, but the feeling I have in general about him is, you know, when you meet university presidents, you're usually meeting somebody who has been in the world of academics for decades. You don't become a university president before you're a dean, before you're a provost, before you're a professor. So you get people who have come up in this consensus building world. They're not used to being visionary. They're not bold. They haven't, in a lot of cases, lived in the real world. And this is not a personal indictment of Oregon's president. I find this to be true of most university presidents and chancellors. It's why they're not bold and visionary. It's probably why they struggle in settings where they are required to make decisions or maybe make unpopular decisions. Their world is really built on consensus. And I had somebody tell me once as I was doing a piece on university presidents, chancellors, they said, you know, they want a unanimous vote always. It's always going to be 12-0. Even if it's 7-5, it's presented as 12-0. That's the world they live in. Nobody sticks their neck out. Nobody's visionary. And I very much get that feeling with Carl Schultz that he's a consensus builder. And, you know, he's an academic. And he's got a background in economics. And, you know, I don't know how else to put this. It's a little geeky, right? And, you know, Stephen, I don't know if you got that feeling. You know, I'm not trying to put the guy down, but it's a little nerdy. The conversation.
Well, yeah, it's because he's not like he's very smart, obviously smarter than I am. But it's not like a sports conversation. This is a sports show, so it's a different conversation you have to have. And they have a different mindset when it comes to sports, right? Like you and me as sports fans, like we're gonna think of sports and think of college sports in a certain way. He's gonna think of it in a totally different way. So it's one of those things where you kind of got to meet in the middle of figuring out what exactly he's trying to say and how he's trying to get about it.
Yeah, and I left kind of going, whoa. You know, he's obviously got a board of trustees. He's got donors he's got to talk with and other academics on his own campus. But here's part two. I'll judge for yourself. Part two of our interview from earlier this week, you're going behind the curtain here. In this section, you're going to hear me ask about the travel demands of the Big Ten Conference, the possible help that Oregon can offer to Oregon State, how can they assist a fellow public institution, and then we get into Autzen Stadium expansion, and then we finally finish with him talking a little bit about Chip Kelly and the life advice that he likes to live by. Here is part two of my conversation with the University of Oregon president, Carl Schultz.
The travel demands, it's come up, you know, and I know that I've talked to some other schools about what they're going to try to do to mitigate that. What do you say to people who are going, oh, just wait for the travel demands on the non-revenue sports. This is going to be brutal, you know. Yeah. What do you say to that?
Well, we're very, very sensitive to it. So I know going from on down to Commissioner Petitti, the athletic directors, Rob Mullins and his peers, are working really, really hard at it. And so, you know, a couple examples, like our women's volleyball team, our outstanding women's volleyball team, played non-conference matches in Hawaii and Pittsburgh. Well, we don't have to do that non-conference because we'll be doing a lot more travel within conference. And so you can adjust travel schedules that way. There's also, I think, creativity being put into matching trips and so that, you know, to minimize the amount of travel. A bunch of our sports, of course, aren't going to be competing in the Big Ten. Mm-hmm. And so there's no difference in travel there. And so we're going to work really, really hard to try to put the interest of the student athletes up front. And I'm pretty optimistic that that's not going to be what people are painting. You know, it's not like every game is going to be in East Piscataway, you know?
Yeah. Oregon State, there's been a negative impact to them with the conference. And, you know, they're going to the state legislature. They're getting assistance now with athletics. Mm-hmm. Can you do anything at Oregon to help Oregon State? Or can that even be on your radar? Or you just
It very much is on. Yeah. I think the state of Oregon needs two successful, thriving R1 universities in the state. I have huge respect for Oregon State, and we'll be trying to do whatever I can do to be helpful, except when we meet on the athletic field. But I think I know you know.
Yeah.
You know, we're scheduling Oregon State. We're playing Oregon State and Corvallis in football next year. We ended up spending, you know, a non-trivial amount of money to tweak our schedule and buy out a couple other teams so that we're able to do that. And so that's, you know, that's one example of us trying to put forward and being good partners.
Yeah, I think, what do you think is going to happen? Like, you know, we keep seeing ideas floated with football splitting away, and football really is different than some of the non-revenue sports. And the Olympic, I'm worried about the Olympic sports, even at Stanford, you know. So much of our Olympic team that we're going to see here in Paris is going to be great athletes that, you know, have thrived in an environment that wasn't all about football. What do you think is going to happen with football? You're an economist. Like, give me an idea of we're not going to hold you to it if it doesn't come true, but 20 years from now, is football separate? Do we have schools having to decide if they want to be, you know, the traditional college institutions or they want to be part of major college athletics? Where's the fork in the road in your mind?
$1 million question. And my crystal ball is probably no better and maybe worse than yours on that. I think with the existing media contracts that are in place, it won't be, you know, tomorrow, but you said 20 years. And 20 years is going to be different, there's no doubt. There's lots of change occurring. Change is going to continue to happen. You know, the next shoe to drop is going to be the various court cases that are kind of winding their way through. Change is going to happen. So, again, I feel very, very fortunate to have as a colleague Rob Mullins. We're in touch with, you know, other presidents, whether through the AAU or through the Big Ten. And, change is coming. 20 years from now, it's hard.
Yeah, it feels like light years. I mean, what we've been through in 9 months.
It's unbelievable. Like,
yeah, and, you know, there's so much money involved. Do you worry that television is too involved?
I think, again, I'm a sports fan. I think the University of Oregon Athletics is beneficial for the university. The TV contracts are part, you know, reflect the interests of big time intercollegiate sports. The TV, you know, there's this kind of narrative out here that the, you know, Fox and ESPN is dictating what's happening on campuses. That's clearly not true. But it's, you know, it's one of the realities that we adapt to.
Now, you're a purist because you're a National League baseball fan. There's no DH. We're both good with that. We're okay with the pitcher batting. So I don't want to sound like an old man on my front lawn. There's some of this that I'm not comfortable with. Even though I love the NCAA tournament, the numbers in women's basketball were just remarkable. You know, I'm tuning in just like everybody else. I'm going to cover the college football playoff like, you know, every other writer. How does any business hold on to its core values while also knowing the world is changing? And you've probably seen that at a variety of schools that you've been at. You have to stay true to your principles, but address the idea that the world is shifting.
Well, I think you said it exactly right. You try to stay true to your principles. Do understand that this is, things are in flux right now, whether it's transfer portal, NIL, things are in flux. It's not going to be this way forever, I don't think. And so we're in a time of transition. And it's fascinating to think about where we end up.
You go to a baseball game, where are you sitting? Where's your preferred? You want to be behind home plate, down one of the lines? Where's your seat?
I probably most enjoy behind home plate. Yeah. if I'm able to.
Yeah. Do you ever get to a game? Do you go to Oregon games or Giants game or?
No. Yeah. So rare occasions. I try to get out to quite a few events around campus, whether sports or music or talks and the like. But my last baseball game was last season for the Ducks. But yeah. I'll try to get out.
Now, I'm trying to tell, since I covered the Big Ten, I got a taste of it, okay? And I was at Wisconsin, IU games, and Drew Brees was the quarterback at Purdue when I was covering Purdue. I've seen Ohio State a number of times. I'm trying to explain to Oregon fans, Washington fans, USC, UCLA, what is ahead. What would you say to, not just to Dan Lanning, but, you know, to the fan bases, that what is the Big Ten going to be like? Give them a primer. Or what's the stadium? Like, you know, do you need to see Camp Randall Stadium?
Yeah, no, I think the opportunity this coming year to see Camp Randall and go to the Big House is going to be great. Having Ohio State come here, it's going to be great. And so, again, the Pac-12 is a storied, great athletic conference. And so think of the, you know, the best of the Pac-12, and that's going to be continuing to come. With maybe a little bit bigger scale, right? Because the Big House and the Shoe in Columbus, you know, hold a few more people. Yeah. So there's going to be that much more intensity, and it's going to be great.
It's probably a question for Rob Mullins, but I'm thinking about the size of Autzen and the 10,000 plus season tickets sold. Have those conversations crossed your desk about the expansion of Autzen?
Of course. So I think we had a almost a 93% renewal rate season tickets this year. I think we're close to plus 11,000 on season tickets. And so we have to look carefully at that. Is that going to be a permanent phenomenon? In which case, what you're saying, one would have to think about it. Boy, should we be expanding Autzen? Or is this, you know, the novelty of joining the Big Ten, having Ohio State come in, and it falls off. But these are sort of the season ticket sales numbers that we saw in the heyday of Coach Kelly's time, and it's something we'll keep a close eye on. We want to make Oregon Duck football accessible for people who want to experience the game day experience. Because the game day experience here is incredible.
I think you have to see Camp Randall. You have to see it. You can't. I try to explain to people what it's like, and even the tailgate as you walk through.
Yeah,
it's next level.
Yeah,
and you know the SEC has some of it too because of the generations of fans who have been through that.
I'm looking forward to jump around when we go out there in November.
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
All right. Best advice you ever got? Or maybe what you think about or draw on.
It's a really good question. Think the best of people until, proven otherwise.
Chip Kelly said that to me.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
There it is. Carl Schultz, president at Oregon. You can see, and by the way, and if anyone ever says, that's a good question, or that's a great question, John, or if you're hearing any interview setting and the guest is saying, that's a good question, they're buying time. They're thinking about their answer. You can see how much more comfortable the president at Oregon is talking about languages and classes and even, venturing off to the Big Ten than he is really in answering a question about, great advice that he got. Stephen Vaughn, I was struck by sort of the strategy. Autzen Stadium, 54,000 seats. You look at, he referenced the big house at Michigan and the horseshoe, the shoe at Ohio State. And, those places you're talking about, 100,000 fans, 90,000 fans for a lot of games, 85,000 plus minimally. Oregon is going to sell out their season ticket allotment, and they're up about 11,000 from last year. But that jumped at me, that Autzen Stadium expansion, which had been shelved for a while, is now a real thing. What about you?
Yeah, that was a very interesting comment he had there, and how it was, is this a fad? Is it just the Big Ten coming in? Or is it here to stay? Because he talked about it's the same type of numbers they had with Chip Kelly, and that's when they made college football playoffs and national championship games. So, very interesting comments there. I don't know if an expansion is the best idea for Oregon. I think the way that they have Autzen Stadium right now is great, so I don't know if an expansion is necessary right now, but I think going forward, it makes a lot of sense to start thinking about it now, just in case they do break off into two giant conferences. You're going to get bigger fan bases in there all the time, and you may need to upgrade that stadium. The other comment I had that I really thought was interesting, John, when you asked him about TV and if they hold too much, if they're too involved with everything going on in college football. He had a long pause. I went back and
checked. Pregnant pause, yeah.
Over 6 seconds of a pause before he answered the question. I thought that was very telling. Like, he did not want to say the wrong thing about how TV is not involved, because that's what he kind of said. Like, oh, no, they're not that involved. Like, we're involved. But he knows where his bread is buttered, and it's by getting that money from the TV deals. I thought it was really interesting that he took over 6 second pause just to figure out exactly what he wanted to say.
It was the longest pause in the interview, and there's a temptation there. As I have the audio, right, and I'm breaking this into two pieces, there's a temptation to go in and go, well, I can cut out 6 seconds there. Listeners are just going to be left hanging. No, I don't want to touch it, because I wanted the listeners to feel what I was feeling in the room. You're right. He did not want to answer that question, or maybe didn't want to say the wrong thing. And by doing that, he's literally affirming the idea that TV's got too much control. Like, he's literally sitting there going, does TV have too much control? Pause, pregnant pause, because he's thinking, like, how do I want to answer this? Because he's worried about the blowback. He's worried about Fox. He's worried about ESPN. He's worried about the Big Ten Conference going, hey, you can't be on record saying that TV has too much influence. And yet we have one of the regents at the University of Michigan who came on the show, Jordan Acker, who said, hey, the presidents have ceded control to the commissioners, and the commissioners have ceded control to the media companies, and this is a problem. And this is, this is part of the issue. Like, this is why the softball team at Michigan should not be running around trying to, fly to Eugene, Oregon to play games. And it doesn't make sense for, the university presidents and the financial interests and all that. Listen to Jordan Acker. He's a regent at the University of Michigan.
This comes down to university presidents have to make this call, and they haven't. Over and over and over again, they do what's right for them, which is fair, but there's no grown-ups in the room. There's no commissioner. You know, Charlie Baker and the NCAA have completely ceded this space, as far as I can tell, to say what's right for the student athletes. And it's clear, and you know this, it's clear that, you know, going to, you know, going, staying, having those games in the Pacific Northwest or in the LA area or in Arizona makes way more sense than athletes getting on a plane and flying to Newark, New Jersey to drive another hour to Rutgers. That's ridiculous. And I think everyone realizes it. The problem is, again, there's no grown-ups in the room to tell people this is wrong, and it doesn't actually make any sense.
Doesn't make any sense. It's wrong, and television is driving that, because television's providing the fuel. It's providing the money. All right, leave it here. We're going to check in on the draft. We'll talk more about the Blazers. Could the Blazers learn from the Kraken? Could they learn how to treat their fan base by watching the Kraken and the NHL? We'll talk about it coming up.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.